This is a production of Cornell University.
First item of business is the approval of the minutes from last week. Are there any amendments to the minutes? To the minutes? Seeing none, Chair would entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
Motion to approve the minutes.
Motion by Ramsey. Seconded by Christina. Without objection, minutes are approved. Our second item of business is late additions to the agenda. Are there any additions to the agenda? Seeing none?
Yeah, I think probably I should do an addition and discuss what's happened with the transportation and that, just to give a debrief on that. So that's okay.
Oh, and then also perhaps along with transportation as well on the pricing.
Okay.
Yeah. So we can do that as one item.
We can kind of work together.
Okay. So noted. Then I would suggest that we change the order of the agenda and move to point 5 next, leaving point 4 until potentially more members arrive. All right. Mike.
Can we just do introductions as well?
Sure.
Since I'm the one talking, I may as well start. I'm Evan Cortens. I'm a graduate student, third-year graduate student in music history. Just finished my A exam, so I guess that makes me ADD. I'll be around here for at least another 2 years, maybe 3 years. But like I say, I'll be the president of the Graduate Professional Student Assembly next year.
My name is Mike Walsh. I'm a PhD candidate in biological and environmental engineering. I've served in many different capacities in campus government, all the way as a vice president on the GPSA to a student trustee, and now as an indentured servant on UA, whose term is finishing pretty soon. I've been asked to kind of do one last thing, which is basically talk a little bit today about the transition of the new charter to hopefully get the new members to speak.
Ari Epstein from the Office of Assemblies, which provides the administrative support for the UA's operations.
I'm Christina Bayer. I'm a human resources specialist in the Department of Women's Studies.
Bill Kendall, I'm a junior in ILR. Sorry, I'm a sophomore. I'm not a junior. I'm going to be a junior next year. I'm going to do my second year on the University of Assembly.
Ned Lassell, CIT staff over in Northern Maple, and like I said, at the University of Santa Fe, employee assemblies for a year and now. This for the second year coming up.
Melissa Lucas Chavez, I've got to be a sophomore, so I'm currently a freshman in ILR. And this is my first move.
Kyle Albert, this last year I was preparation chair for the QTSA, and continuing as voting member there and I attend this assembly. And in the sociology department, I'm PhD, finishing my second year.
My name is Ramsey Atai. I'm a sophomore in ILR.
So while we're talking introductions, there's one member from the GPSA side of things who's not here, who's here last week, Sean Murphy. And that's the full graduate professional student delegation. Are there? We're just doing introductions.
Okay.
I recognize your picture as having been voted in. Don't recall your name.
Phil Goldstein.
Phil Goldstein?
Yes.
From NA.
U.S.
Undergraduate.
Yes. The undergraduate.
Are there any? Is that the full?
I think there's one more undergraduate. Yeah.
It would be Natalie, right?
Office will be as well.
No, that's it.
Wait, no, Ramsey is outgoing.
There's four. Right? Yeah.
No, you're staying.
I'm staying.
Wait a minute.
No,
you're not staying.
I am staying.
There should be four plus the chair. So the four of you plus Natalie.
Oh, okay, plus Natalie.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is Natalie aware that she's now a member of the UA?
It was my understanding that she got the same email.
Is the president always the
chair? I'll be happy to talk about that.
But do we know about any other employee assembly members that are the elections not taking place yet?
I don't think we have the results yet. No. I don't think RID.
The elections were just completed last week, but they have not had their organizational meeting yet, which is probably, you know, we were talking about how there would be issues with the charter to confront. One of them is definitely the timing of other assemblies' elections versus when the UA is supposed to seat its new members.
Okay. I mean, speaking hypothetically, we can't really move this meeting forward in time very much, can we? This is the last week of classes.
Well, what we have done in the past is sort of on an interim basis, basically say these people will be the executive board for the summer based on whoever's available at this point in time, and then in the fall have the election that really sets it for the rest of the year.
Okay. And we already discussed that, at least Howie and Randy may or may not be returning.
Do we know that already?
Two other people?
We don't know it because the Faculty Senate doesn't finalize their appointments until July.
Thank you.
And are faculty members who were, their term was 2 years, so faculty members in the middle of their term, I'm assuming they were, how many of them? Two? Three?
How are we looks like Howie's coming back.
How are we managing that?
Plus the dean of the faculty.
Yes.
And Randy and Howie, I guess, would you want to do
it?
Yeah, so Howie is continuing. And Randy is continuing.
Okay.
And
so it's after that point, two more people.
Four plus one.
The faculty have four spots? I
four, say yes.
Two.
They have four.
Okay.
Plus the dean, exactly.
There you go. We think you just, even the people who aren't here.
Yes.
Nothing's not covered.
So I'm ready.
Okay.
So again, and just as a new member who just walked in the room, I am one of the outgoing members, and I was asked, you know, primarily by the executive board, and specifically one person on the executive board, to talk about transition today and to introduce some of the new members to the charter, the changes in the charter that we made this year. And I'll be brief, mostly because there's only three new people in the room right now, and I'm sure there'll be more in the fall at a later date. But I think it's good, you know, if any decisions are going to be made today, even on an interim basis, that it's good that we go ahead and just get everybody up to speed and on the same page here. So some brief history for those who are new. The UA was formed back in the 1980s as a part of the new system of governance back then. And since that time, very little has changed up until this year, especially with the UA's charter and how that operated. And a lot of stuff at the university changed. So, you know, there was a challenge. This charter that we had did not basically meet the modern needs of all the constituencies and administration at this university. There was another challenge in there as well, and that challenge was an amendment clause stating that the charter had to be amended by, 20% of each a vote that included 20% of the members of each constituency on this campus. And miraculously, we got that done last year and amended the charter to get rid of that requirement so we could then go in and just take a hacksaw, you know, rewrite it, start from scratch, just try to figure out, you know, where we wanted to take the UA, you know, in the future. And we looked at the stuff that UA has been historically involved in and, you know, should be involved in terms of what issues matter to all the constituencies at the university. And we really wanted to, you know, give the UA authority in policy development, in advising the university and having to develop a policy in specific areas that are important to everybody at this university. I mean, you know, typically undergrads have an interest in, residential stuff or dining stuff, you know, faculty and staff might have their own specific interests. We try to identify the areas that were important to everybody. And those were the code of conduct, campus planning, diversity and inclusion, environmental impact and sustainability, family support, health services,
a very new one that we brought in with information technology. Another new one will be public safety, and one of the old, actually well working ones was transportation and commuter services, which we're actually in discussion about which right now. I should mention that this is actually a clip from the charter right now, as it stands approved by the president, and will go into effect on June 1st. As you can see, it also has the statement that these matters may include the list that I just spoke, but are not necessarily limited to. Again, any issue that affects, the wide, community degree, the entire community at Cornell is an issue that this assembly, can concern itself with. And I encourage you to take advantage of that. If there's a sustainability issue, if there's a child care issue, if there's a transportation issue, bring it to this group. Funnel, the students or faculty or staff or graduates that you represent, towards this assembly. Funnel their energy towards this assembly to get their views heard. Additionally, another big thing, and I won't really go into this too deeply, but this was, I think, a big win for us in this whole charter rewrite. Basically stating that, the second paragraph there, officers of the university should consider a consultation with the assembly before implementing other significant actions or policy which involve the interest or concern the welfare of a substantial segment of the campus community. So this is basically saying right now, before any issues come up, you have to, if you're an administrator at this university and if you're thinking of a major policy change, you have to go and consult this body. And this was actually, an exciting thing for us to get in this charter, and I think it's going to be a very valuable tool for many great conversations with the administration as we go forward. And hopefully this body will grow to get the respect, that the administration feels very comfortable with going to this body to get buy-in of all the constituencies, of all the, of everybody at Cornell. So I think this is a big win for the assembly moving forward, and something to be cognizant about as you move forward or serve on a committee of the UA. This is just an org chart. I know some of it's kind of small, so sorry, Ned, everybody in the back. But I just wanted to kind of sketch out how, we see the university assembly, breaking down and what its parts are. I should say this, a lot of analogies have gone around, trying to describe, the UA as a legislative body, as a, an internal board of trustees, or whatever. I like to think about it as a city or town council, addressing, a lot of the town issues that go on, a lot of the, the local important issues that go on in a collaborative way. So at the top is this body. And it has about 18 total members. There are 4 appointed by the Student Assembly, Employee Assembly, and the Faculty Senate. 2 appointed by the GPSA. That was set, and those numbers were picked primarily to try and align with the population size. It's not perfect. Faculty are a little bit overrepresented, but not as overrepresented as they have been in the past. In addition, there is one member. The chair of each constituent assembly serves as an ex officio, voting. Some people mistake voting ex officio with not being non-voting, but it's a voting ex officio member of the university assembly. Good question.
No.
The university assembly is steered by an executive committee. Which includes the president, executive vice president, a vice president for operations, and a ranking member. And it's a 4-person executive committee, and it can have no more than one member be from the same constituency. So there has to be one faculty member, one undergraduate member, one graduate member, and one employee member serving in one of those roles. And that's not to say that one of the assembly chairs can't serve as a chair of the university assembly. That can happen if that person chooses to take on that extra work. So the university assembly will probably be meeting twice a month next year, I assume.
Once to twice.
Once to twice a month as need be.
on Tuesdays at 4.
30.
3.
4.30.
4.30, I'm sorry.
Tuesdays at that.
Yes, Tuesdays at 4.30.
That was done to avoid conflicts with the faculty senate meetings that happened at the same time on some Wednesdays.
This is easy to change.
Every assembly has its own day.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And so what we did when we looked at the charter, we had about 12 committees associated or affiliated with UA at some point.
Sounds about right.
Some of them were completely dormant. Some of them were just sitting around trembling their thumbs. Some of them were very active. And it was, you know, very hard to manage, you know, manage this. I mean, there were references in there to, you know, a budget committee, in the old charter to a budget committee and the University Health Services Committee that just weren't meeting at all. And, you know, we really wanted to take a look at it and see, you know, how this has been working, what's been working well, how we can fix it and improve it, and given, you know, the membership constraints that we do have, time limitations of people, what's the model that can best work to organize this body in the future? And what we decided to do after going back and forth, and, you know, even arguing inside ourselves which way to go, we decided to go with a few but broad committee model, where we have just a small number of committees, but they have a broad area of interest. And that was primarily done because it just didn't make sense to have a number of committees, you know, sitting around waiting for issues to come up. But to have, you know, these you know, kind of larger scope committees that can, you know, be flexible to deal with issues as they arise. And if need be, these committees may form subcommittees as needed. So I think the way it's somewhat laid out in the charter is there are three types of committees. There's standing committees of the university assembly, and those are what you would think as a traditional, typical, you know, this body delegates a certain amount of work to get things done, to ask for information or whatever. I'll go into those in a second. But then we have two other groups, associated committees, one of which is campus planning. It's a historically active committee. And we pretty much kept it as is. There's a linkage with that in the UA, and that means the chair of that serves as an ex officio member of the university assembly, and will probably require that person to give a report every once in a while as campus planning needs arise. Public safety is a brand new committee that's in the process of being formed. Again, it's going to follow a similar kind of link model with the UA. There's also a set of independent hearing boards, the University Hearing Board and the Transportation Hearing and Appeals Board, that basically are judicial boards that just need the University Assembly approval to staff them, to approve the slate of candidates for those boards. The main actions of the UA are going to be done through three committees, codes and judicial. Again, that committee has been historic. That's actually the only standing committee that we kept pretty much as is, because they deal with such an important issue, the campus code of conduct. It played a huge role in rewriting the campus code of conduct about 2 or 3 years ago, and I'm sure we'll be gearing back up for some of the recent developments starting this fall. The campus welfare committee is supposed to take on the issues of diversity, family support, health services, and the Campus Infrastructure Committee will take on sustainability, IT, and transportation. I chaired the Sustainability Committee this year, and I think this is a great idea because it was very difficult for us to address some of the issues of sustainability in the vacuum. You know, being able to be tasked with making sure that this campus is more sustainable while looking at other infrastructure needs like information technology and transportation is going to be a very valuable thing to really move, I think, these conversations in the right direction. And so that's what they're looking at. These three committees are going to be staffed in a interesting way that we all went back and forth on and eventually going to came down to a conclusion. Each of these three committees are going to have 11 members total, in addition to potential ex officio members of the administration, non-voting members. And so three of those members
three of those 11 will be appointed by the University Assembly, and one of those persons will be, I think, the chair. Is that how we have it designed? It wasn't quite clear.
I think the plan was that the UA would appoint a chair from those three as well.
From those three. I think this is so we did this because in the past the UA would just appoint a chair to some of these committees, and that would be the only link. And that made things very difficult. It kept them on a long leash. You know, we didn't know what they were up to at times. We wanted to bring them closer to home. And we would have, I think, liked to put more University Assembly members on these committees, but looking at the fact that we have 18 people, a lot of them are wearing different hats already, we needed to basically put three or four with all we could really point to these committees. The rest of the committees are going to be filled up with two members from each constituency. One of those members can be anybody from that constituency. And the other one has to be a member of the voting, a voting member of the constituency assembly. So an FA voting member or a GPSA voting member. And that's really done to really also draw the direct line from these committees at the committee level now to each of the constituent assemblies. And I think this is going to be a strong link to really help funnel, again, these issues that are a common concern to everybody, funnel those issues from each constituent assembly directly to the committee that's supposed to handle it. The constituent assembly appoints both those members, both one of its members as well as one kind of at-large community member to these committees. So it's a complex model, but I'm hoping that it'll work. I'm hoping that it'll increase and facilitate communication. To make it work, it's really going to require a commitment from this body and each of the constituent assembly leaderships. And I hope that if you see one of these committees not being staffed, that you go to both your chair on this body and your chair back in the chair of the constituent assembly that you are of the constituency that you represent and say, hey, we're not being fully represented on this committee, and just make sure that that's staff, because these committees need people to work, obviously, and I think they'll have a lot of success if they have those people. Just to quickly go over the officers, this is just pulled right out of the new charter. The role of the president, the chair of this body, has really not changed too much. Again, and this hopefully will help as each of you consider running for something today, but the chair presides over the meeting, serves as spokesperson for the assembly, and transmits any formal recommendations, resolutions. The executive vice chair presides over the executive board, basically does a lot of the logistical stuff for the assembly, tracking reports, resolutions, where they're going, assists the chairs in things as needed, prepares the agenda, and sits in place of the chair when the chair is absent. We created a new position called the vice chair for operations, and given the fact that we wanted to focus, really try and ramp up our committee work this year, we felt that a new position would be beneficial. And this person is their role to basically monitor the activities of each committee of the assembly. I guess they can approve expenses. I didn't know we had a budget. I guess we might now. Really try and make sure that each committee is staffed, communicating well with the executive board, getting their reports in on time, and if the chair and the executive vice chair is gone, that person fills in this seat. And then to kind of close out the bunch, there's a ranking member who is the other constituency who is not represented, and that basically comprises the executive committee. Again, there are these committees, codes and judicial, campus welfare, campus infrastructure. They'll need chairs, they'll need UA members to steer them and lead them. I think with all these issues, they'll be active. So, any questions, especially for the interviews? Hopefully that clarifies things and introduced you to how this is supposed to work, or how we hoped it would work, and hope that you, you know, get working next year.
I have a question about the Article 3.1.3 thing, the bit about that people should consult the Assembly,
mm-hmm.
And should consider designating us a stakeholder in the policy formation process. Is that enforced anywhere? Is that now documented through the Office of University Policy?
Well,
or is it just in our charter?
Well, the funny part about the charter is it's a university policy. So it's not under the policy on policies, but the president
right.
said this is the law for the university.
Okay.
So what that says actually is shall consider designating the Assembly as a stakeholder, which means
yeah.
the Assembly is a presumptive stakeholder in every policymaking process.
Okay.
And actually, I went and looked through, and in the policy office's documentation, it lists the Assembly as one of the groups that should be considered for consultation already.
Right, yeah. And I think the other assemblies are listed, too.
It just doesn't happen quite as systematically as it probably should. That is, there isn't a formal sharing of the impact statement really early on, which I think is kind of the key starting point for a lot of these discussions. And for the campus code of conduct and the parking and traffic regulations, it also says that the Assembly must be consulted. And for everything else, it says should consider consultation. So the idea there is there are probably going to be more policies that should be listed as must consult over time, but the UA is as issues come up, it's going to have to decide whether it wants to have those added.
Yeah, I think I should add that we stripped it. I think we really tried to strip the old charter down and make this kind of, you know, as bare bones as possible so it can be, you know, more flexible in the future. There are a number of committees and issues, that I, you know, foresee becoming associated committees in the future, you know, just because of their role and how the university operates. So there's potential for growth. I mean, we just decided, you know, let's slim things down as much as we can and you know, just get, you know, those key things like, you know, the administrative buy-in and this, like, shall consider, you know, working with the Assembly.
Are there any other questions for Mike?
That I can think of.
Thanks.
Thank you. Well, unfortunately, the next item of business is election.
I hope I didn't scare you, any of you, from running.
Unless you'd rather talk about transportation first, something nice and uncontroversial, and then we can do elections.
Well, yeah, I guess we could talk about that first. I just didn't feel comfortable with the respect of how, like, we, during the last meeting, when we introduced all those things regarding the change in the prices for all the parking spots, it was more of a, it seemed as if it was more of a matter of fact, and that, you know, it didn't really give us time, considerable time to consider this. I don't think
yeah.
we can have another meeting to discuss this. So
yeah, I don't know if anybody knows about that. I wasn't sure where Joe Lally stands on this. Is this basically a set, it's approved, and it's just a matter of breaking the bad news, or do we have a say in this?
Well, he mentioned it was draft 46 that he was working on or whatever.
Right,
so
yeah.
He, I think he was actually pretty, not explicit, but he implied a couple times that he was open some changes.
Right.
And I think they have discussed with TAC, and unfortunately Ed is at a TAC meeting right now. And the way I see this happening in the future is, you know, they would go over all the details primarily with the Campus Infrastructure Committee when they do make these changes like that.
Right.
But this year, you know, it's certainly been a lot of changes and just coming at the wrong time and
yeah.
probably in the wrong direction.
I was going to say it's difficult for us to engage in the process when we get it in the
yeah.
final 15 minutes of our
last meeting of the
session. But, I mean, if that's the way it works on their end, I guess that's I mean, one thought, I was talking to somebody, I know, Ned, that this is an issue for you, the motorcycle issue. Not just the fact that you're double charged and that it's switching to an annual thing and that it's a significant price increase, but the way they calculated the price increase is by saying, well, they take one-third of the space, so we'll charge you one-third of the rate. Well, the problem, as I understand it, is that a good chunk of the spots that are designated for motorcycles are actually taken away in the winter. Never mind that you can't drive the bike in the winter already. The university takes away the spots. So they're even allowing, the way they design parking, the fact that, sure, you take one-third of a spot, but only for three-quarters of the year, two-thirds of the year.
And you're charged for the whole year.
And you get charged for the whole year at a prorated.
Yeah, they if I can address that part, because after last Wednesday, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last Wednesday.
So last Wednesday, I became the designated motorcycle representative for all the university to Joe Valley, apparently. and I'm not kidding. I received interesting emails from police officers from that ride or what. Okay. So long and short of it is, like I said in the last meeting, what got brought up was, like you said, a double charge at minimum. And previous to this, if you don't know, it was a lifetime.
One-time fee
per motorcycle.
Yeah.
And if you're a crazy person like me, you have two motorcycles, so they both have a bag on them. So, and I will say, I mean, Joe Wally, a little bit to my surprise from history that I've heard, was very responsive. Oh my goodness, we never intended to double charge you. He immediately contacted me the next day. And by Friday, he asked if he could meet with me. I was really clear that, I mean, I represent myself, really. I mean, I try to represent as best I can. So the point is that as it stands right now, the draft that they're drafting, and they were presenting today to the Employee Assembly up in Geneva, was, it's the way it probably should be anyways, is, they want to tick the commuter permits to be vehicle agnostic. So if you drive a motorcycle or a car or whatever, if you have a commuter permit for, say, ME or for iPark or whatever, you can use that for your motorcycle, your car, or whatever. So it's single use, but whatever vehicle you have. So that makes some sense. Yeah.
Right.
And then there was interesting dialogue between a couple of people that ride. And I know one person went straight to legal, I think. So anyway, there was some interesting things about legally, did we purchase a lifetime permit, and how can you revoke that? Is there some contract, implied contractual? Anyhow, the other thing is that they are going to grandfather in permits to last forever, until you get a new bike. And you can even get lifetime permits up until, I think the draft is going to be, I haven't even seen it, but it's going to be up until either January or September, I can't remember what. So that's okay. So the only part that was not
addressed,
given at all, was, and I multiple times kind of pushed it back, similar to what you said, is I said, a one-third calculation doesn't make sense. Just from a usability standpoint, I understand mathematically how you're doing it, but similar to what you said, space gets taken away, you can ride one third to one half of the season. There are people that ride year round, but going from a lifetime fee of a fixed cost that's pretty minimal to an annual fee that's one third is kind of exorbitant, I would think. And they, at this point, what I heard yesterday was that's not going to change. So as of either January or September, when if you decide to get a motorcycle equivalent for a motorcycle to drive on campus, and you don't have a commuter permit, it will cost you that whatever it was, $115 or
$120.
And I guess that's what it is. And so negotiations will have to happen. I mean, if we feel that that's unfair or somebody feels that they'll have to go through normal process to try to get that changed or something. So, but that's, I will say I'm encouraged by the give and take that's happening. It was very good. I agree 100% that I think that it was kind of like we got everybody late to the party type of thing, you know. I mean, it's pretty significant, and it is a visceral, it's a very visceral thing for people that are staff or whatever, I'm sure students do, but at the average increase between 3.6 and 5.6 or something
like that. About 6%, yeah.
And they came around, but I mean, they are trying to simplify the permitting, I think, which is, that's a good thing. And they struggle with a lot, and I don't represent the tax, so I mean, I just don't speak for this, but they lost, this didn't get mentioned in the last meeting, I didn't want to bring it up because it really was from a third party, but my understanding is, in this time of financial crunch, they, as an entity for parking, they did not, they lost a certain income stream that they had, that anytime you build a building, at Cornell, a certain percentage of that total cost of the building, I think it was on the order of 4%, 5%, would go straight to parking as an income. So if it was a $2 million building, take 3-5% of that, that's going to go straight towards having parking spaces defined for that. They got removed. So now they have a constraint that way, so I think, you know, they're scrambling. So that's not an excuse, I'm just saying that they're scrambling. So, that's all I know.
Just to add on to it, the fact of how is the rush, like, leave. I was trying to think of alternatives of what they could do to try to, because I remember they said they're about 500,000. And, you know, what if they could have, like, a possibility between increasing the percent? I don't think you can run away from the fact that they're going to increase the rates.
Right.
But, I mean, I think there's more than one way to approach this matter to reach that, I guess, to compensate that $500,000. So, for instance, increasing, I'm just thinking out loud, just increasing the fines for those who are parking, like, who have a parking violation, that could be one thing. I guess the other thing I didn't like about what he said is that the point of Cornell is to provide an incentive for people to use public transportation and to reduce gas emissions, right? Mm-hmm. But those incentives have decreased, from my understanding, at least from the last meeting. Mm-hmm. Those incentives have been curbed significantly. So
they did remove.
It was a car share discount, not a car share rebate fund.
Yeah. Car share refund, and then also, I think I could be wrong though. I'd have to double check of how where they could park if you're on a car share plan. I think they restricted it only to one spot.
Yeah, they did.
Avon versus
no,
it's not into a particular lot. It's
you choose.
They've gotten rid of. They said they wanted to, as much as possible, not have reserved spaces that are associated with a particular person or user, and I think that's from an efficiency standpoint, that if that person isn't using that day, it means that parking spot isn't available.
So it's vacant, yeah.
But that wasn't with the ride share. That was just something. I don't think that was with the ride share. He was saying that he was planning on, instead of, the way it works is you get a discount for each person that participates in the ride share. And at one point in that whole layout, they were actually having to pay people.
Right.
They had four or five people in a ride share. The university was paying them. So they were eliminating that, and they said in exchange for that, they were going to give an assigned parking spot for the ride share. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that is, if you've got five people that work in five different locations on campus, where do you put the spot? I mean, they thought that through, but
yeah.
It didn't make sense to me.
And that's why I was hoping to maybe see if there's a possibility where they can be more flexible in saying, like, oh, you know, these are the five people that are registering, like, what are your preferred parking spots? So that when you guys take turns, that at least that's my understanding, when you guys take turns driving each other, you can each go, like...
Well, yeah, and that's what I had asked him about that day, and he kind of dodged it. But it's a problem for me. Like, I am in a ride share, and if that the person that I ride share with is on vacation, I can't park near my building. You know, it's not interchangeable. While one person's away, you can't park near your building unless you stop at the parking booth. Well, their solution to that was I stop at the parking booth, and the guy gives me a handicap tag, which I'm morally against. I'm not handicapped. I'm not requesting a handicap spot. And there's no policy on the transportation page of if you're in a rideshare, what should you do in the event that the person you rideshare with is on vacation or disability or whatever.
Yeah.
They need to come up with another accommodation for the other person or persons in the rideshare. That doesn't involve handicapped space, because that's just wrong.
I agree. I'd also add that I was somewhat disappointed that there was very little attention paid to student needs in terms of parking, because especially with graduate professional students, it's always been a nightmare. I mean, I've lived on campus, about four years here, I think, and had to each year buy an on-campus permit, which is now $700, which is the same price that the undergraduates pay for their on-campus permit. And I don't want to pick on you guys, but I think there's a difference between a freshman bringing their car to campus and a graduate student with a family. And some of the cases, like I see around my neighbors, like in Hasbrook, who have to pay $600-$700 on a limited income for that. And I've known graduate students, when I lived out actually in Schuyler House, there would be plenty of spots open, but a lot of my dorm mates would not purchase them and prefer to shift their car back and forth on the streets in the middle of winter every day.
Yeah.
And so it's been tough. And again, there's the issue of graduate students not being able to participate in car share.
Even though we
have people coming from towns half an hour away. And they're charged the same, they're again charged $700 for a commuter pass.
Yes.
Where employees, who park in a lot get to get for free.
Yeah.
That's what I would notice is it seems to me, speaking generally, that the sort of more the graduate and professional students are more likely to live further away from campus.
Mm-hmm. Because of housing prices, of a number of different issues. And
so you find yourself in a situation where if you do need to come into campus occasionally, your options are very limited. To talk about transit subsidies, the issue for me, I was parking on Thurston for a while, and there were meters on Thurston, so $2.25 for an entire day. For my fiance and myself, which was another graduate student, to take the bus in was $6. Now we could buy a bus pass, but then we may as well buy a parking pass. Two bus passes is the same cost as a parking pass, and you get a free bus pass with your ALOT pass. And that presentation, the one that was last week, didn't mention students at all.
Just mentioned from the
And granted, we're a smaller parking constituency, but I would note, by the way, in passing, that it sounds like a number of people might be interested in joining the campus infrastructure committee next year. It sounds like I'm hearing some people who are passionate about transit issues. I would note that for the record.
No, but the graduate student parking, I think that is a significant problem. And I rent an apartment above my garage, and I live in Ellis Hollow. And I called parking and said, look, I've got two graduate students that are living on my property, and they'd like to participate in this ride share, and they would not.
Yeah. I understand the limitations, but I understand part of the parking thing is too, it's a shared benefit plan or whatever. What's the term for that? I think it's shared benefits. Some of the shared the employee benefits, HR benefits goes to subsidize parking, but again, those situations really should be addressed.
So maybe with both infrastructure and sustainability.
Yeah.
Especially since it kind of goes against what Cornell stands for in a way, with like reducing emissions.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think they're trying to do the best with the limitations that they have, but again, it's one of those issues where a constituency, and in this case, my constituency, is kind of being, I think, left out of considerations. And I think we saw that from that report. I don't want to beat this to death, but I know TAC is meeting right now, actually, and this is the end of the year, but it's something to consider as walking this way.
Yeah, I guess that's what I would say, maybe rhetorically, but where do we go from here? How do we keep pressing this issue? How do we make sure that, the voice of all constituencies is heard? I mean, this comes back to the point about Article 313, about you know, I think that's how the university assembly is really trying to define itself as a touchstone for the feeling of the community. The idea being that, you know, we can really help you out, administrative unit X, in soliciting community input, in communicating this sort of thing, in helping with buy-in, so that, as we saw with a number of issues this year, they're not presented as this sort of fait accompli, you know, made in a, whether or not they were, but with the perception that they were made off in an office somewhere by the hand-picked committee, you know, that wasn't public or transparent. That may not be true, but that is certainly the perception of the issues.
I remember...
Ari.
I think at some point, you know, getting back to the because this assembly isn't going to be seated officially until June 1st under the current charter, and at any rate, I think it's going to be, you know, difficult to do a lot of substantive work on this over the summer. That it might be good to move to the elections part.
Point well taken.
I also wanted to say and apologize for the way that officers are chosen for the assembly and staffing is done is broken. And we identified this last year. I think kind of an oversight that we didn't get around to fixing it in the charter revision. But as you can see, we have no faculty representatives today. And the employee representatives are still kind of lonely. what we have done in the past, because it's the same problem that we've had every year for at least the last 6 years, is that we get the point people who will be the executive committee for the summer, and then in the fall, at the first meeting, is when the real organizational meeting happens, because that's when everybody is staffed. And it probably would be good next fall for us to turn that into something official in the charter that...
Until the process, yeah.
Yeah, maybe the current executive board should continue to be the official executive board until the first meeting in the fall.
The only possible issue there could be if someone was graduating and they're serving a term that goes to the end of May, then they're not going to be around. I mean, the other possible way to do it is, and I don't know if the other constituencies are amenable to this, I mean, the SA has an election on March 1st. The GPSA, we do ours the middle of April. I don't know if it might be possible to encourage the Faculty Senate and Employee Assembly to see if they can move up their selection process by a week or two. And that way we can have it all in place, because this is really the latest this meeting can happen, the last week of class.
Mm-hmm. I feel like last year it wasn't an issue, it was different last year.
I think we had a lot of returning members last year.
Yeah.
And Ed and Charlie were basically sitting in the same role that they were. They were
right.
They were both the previous chair and vice chair the year before.
Sorry, Ari, I didn't mean to cut you.
And I was also going to suggest, since there's no faculty representation, that the highest ranking faculty member would be the dean of faculty, so that I'm just going to volunteer him as the ranking member of the faculty for the summer, since he's elected by all the faculty.
Well, he's not here, so we can't object.
Yeah.
would there be... okay, this one.
So how the elections, we have three positions then to fill, a chair, a vice chair, and the vice chair of operations.
Mm-hmm.
I think basically how it should proceed is that we should elect in that order. So for the first position, the chair would be open to the remaining three constituencies. The next one would be open to the remaining two constituencies, and then the third constituency would caucus among themselves and choose. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think typically, though, it's been a wider... It's not really a caucus thing at that point.
I'm sorry. Everybody votes on the
yeah.
Okay. The lower list.
Sure.
Yeah.
strike my previous. But I suppose an election in that case would only occur if there were more than one nominee from that constituency. Otherwise, it would be by acclamation, possibly. Anyway, never mind.
Call for nominations for chair.
That's what I was going to do.
And this would just be, all of these would just be until the first organizational meeting. So maybybe there should be some background on that. The way the UA is set up, because there are some policies that are quite dependent upon the UA, particularly the Campus Code of Conduct, which actually has had some legal compliance issues come up.
I'd like you to talk about that at the end.
Okay. There are some legal compliance questions that came up about it, and there's actually a provision in the UA charter that says the executive board over the summer can speak on behalf of the UA, and if something needed to be changed on an interim basis, it would be able to speak on behalf of the UA and do that so that it would not be a major institutional crisis, because there's a group in place that can make those decisions.
And that term would run from the 1st of June until our first organizational meeting. The old executive is still in effect until May 31st.
So that would be, and the first organizational meeting should be, the first UA meeting in the fall should be the last week of August.
So what we're voting on, excuse me, what we're voting on right now is for an executive board for the summer.
Yes. So, and you don't have to be on campus. I mean, decisions can be made by email or, if necessary, a conference call. So
the floor is open for nominations for the position of chair. I nominate Mike Walsh. No. Anybody? Anybody? Self-nominations
maintained.
Mike can't do it. What sort of workload are we thinking here? Not a lot of work, right?
Hopefully no work at all.
Maybe one or two emails.
I can do it, man. So I'll nominate.
One nomination. Do we have any further nominations for the position of interim chair from June 1st to the end of August?
I'll do it. I can do it.
Two nominations.
What about you? I'd like to just, can I nominate?
I'm already the chair of something.
Okay. Can I actually nominate Evan?
Thank you.
Even though you are the chair of something.
Okay. Yeah. I'll accept that nomination. We have three nominations for the position of chair. Any further nominations?
Nominate Evan.
Evan's already been nominated. Seeing no further nominations.
I just wanted to chime in here briefly with a comment, and I hope the chair will entertain that. I welcome the enthusiasm of the new members, but just given the issues that have cropped up over the past couple of weeks, I would be very comfortable leaving this assembly with somebody who has been around. It's that is why I nominate Evan, but if there's anybody else in that. Yeah.
Nomination withdrawn.
Seeing no further nominations, we still have two nominations on the floor.
I'll withdraw my nomination if you're on board.
I guess I'm going to be overseas, that's the thing. I got an internship overseas, and yeah. It's like an 8-hour difference in time zones.
That's
so
fine.
Okay.
Good excuse.
All right, then. I guess that settles it. I'll be the chair of the University Assembly and the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly starting June 1st for 2 months, 3 months.
I was just thinking, because we do have all of the heads of assemblies as official, as now ex officio voting members of this assembly, and they are all quite experienced, I think, you know, if nobody from that constituency feels comfortable taking on that role because you don't have past experience in UA, I
think it might be fine to nominate them to have that.
We've already done that in one case.
I think on an interim basis that's something that's a very good idea.
Yeah, just for
considered something that could be made permanently effective.
Because I'm thinking, you know, for instance, undergraduate the student assembly president was elected by the whole student body. I don't think anybody is going to challenge their ability to speak on behalf of students if something comes up over the summer. In the case of employees, we do have two experienced members, one of whom has been on the executive board before. But certainly for faculty, since they're not.
Yeah.
I think
Bill Fry would be the person to.
Yeah.
So we move now to nominations for the position of vice chair. This is open to anybody from either the employee constituency or the undergraduate constituency. And
I'll nominate myself for that one, because that one is not. That's the vice chair.
Yeah. Christina? We have two nominations for the position of vice chair. I assume no further nominations. Do we have to vote by closed ballot?
I think yes.
Well, as the new chair of the university assembly over the summer, I don't plan to hold any executive board meetings. So I've already gotten an executive board.
Yes.
Wouldn't want a Lisa Murkowski moment to happen here. We might be stuck in recounts forever. Phil with an F, right?
Yeah.
Sorry. Bad Alaska Senate politics joke. Sorry.
Yeah.
Speaking of the great wide
north. Oh yeah, you may borrow my pen,
Evan. Speaking of the great wide north.
Yes, we had an election on Monday.
What's your opinion on Canada?
Well, I have many opinions.
The reaction. Yeah. There are many parties in Canada.
There are.
It's natural for Canadians to have many opinions.
I'm surprised by the fairly dramatic shift. Michael Ignatieff, who's the leader of the Liberal Party, taught at Harvard for about 10 years, and his party had the single worst showing, I think, that they've ever had. He lost his own seat, which never happens. The leader never loses his own election. And they have, I think, the lowest number of seats ever. They're down to somewhere in the neighborhood of about 20 seats. The big winner is the NDP, which is the sort of Canadian party to the left, the socialist party, I guess you might call them, but socialist in the, you know, sense that that word really means, you know, like public health care, public education and things. Anyway, they did very well. The surprise there is that it was Quebec. Quebec normally votes very strongly for the Bloc Québécois, the separatist party, but they voted overwhelmingly for the NDP. So the Bloc Québécois is left at four seats. So the results are in. Christina, you are our new vice chair. So we have one further position to fill. That's the position of, is it vice chair for operations? Isn't it?
Yes.
I'm saying
that
right.
True.
This position is open only to undergraduates now, as the only remaining constituency.
Melissa
nominates herself. So noted. Any other nominations, self or otherwise?
So no meetings with herself.
Right.
You can schedule your own meeting.
Wait.
This again, as Ari said, what? You know, if something comes up and the executive board needs to speak on behalf of the university assembly. You know, the steering of this body can be done by the real executive in the fall.
Yeah.
It was the one concern with that campus code of conduct, right?
Right.
Yeah, that was the big one, though.
Yeah. Though that being said, for those who weren't here last Wednesday, we did pass an amendment that addressed the immediate legal issue. And that will, from my perspective, and
as you may know, I'm not a lawyer, will probably take care of it.
The one other thing that has come up in the summer is, I don't know what it was about last summer, but there were a lot of students referred to the judicial administrator over the summer, and the way our code is set up, there are certain hearings that have to happen, and it worked out that there were not enough students around that summer who were in the hearing and review board pool. So the solution, which seems to be blessed by the executive committee, was to deputize student tour guides who were on campus.
Great.
Who Peggy Beach, the director of our office, and of campus information and visitor relations, persuaded to volunteer. So that's the one other thing that I could picture you being asked to do, is approve a slate of people to serve on those boards for the summer.
Yeah, I'll nominate myself.
Okay, Randy, we have two nominations for the position of Vice Chair for Operations. Are there any further nominations for the position? Seeing none, the floor is closed for nominations. We do have to vote by closed ballot again.
Sure.
What you're trying to
or speed on the
Permanently
committed.
Yeah.
Permanently indentured.
That's right. Just fall through the ear and you'd be all set.
Walk out of this room today.
Free man until your wedding in a couple of weeks.
Too much. Too much.
Well, where are you holding it?
Maine. Maine. The way life should be.
You're not from Maine, are you?
People actually think it's Canadian problem.
Was part of Massachusetts for about 100 years.
I'm from New Hampshire, and I'm usually close.
Any other questions about Canadian politics?
What part are you from?
I'm from Calgary. It's a part that consistently, including this election, votes conservative. Who will form the majority of government, and the Prime Minister will remain Stephen Harper. So Ramsey wins the election. So we have an interim executive board for the summer. I'll be the chair. Christina, Ramsey, and Bill Fry, the dean of the faculty.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the further item on the agenda, the late addition, someone I forget now who mentioned discussing the campus code of conduct.
Well, actually, would it be worthwhile to talk about committees?
Yeah. Then,
oh, sorry. That's on here.
I don't know. I'm assuming at least one person would be. Some people here who haven't enrolled yet would be interested in getting started on committees. Even though there's probably not going to be much action over the summer, but I think it will help to, you know, start planning, strategize.
So just to reiterate, we have three standing committees, and we need to staff three positions on each of those two committees. As I recall, the charter does not specify any sort of distribution requirement. So they could be three employees on a particular committee or whatever. The hope I would imagine is that one person doesn't find themselves serving on all three committees, but rather that each constituency tries to make sure that the workload is relatively fairly balanced. So three committees: campus infrastructure, campus welfare, and CJC. Well,
so there's three committees and three members per committee. So should we, I guess, decide on maybe two UA members per committee, since the faculty isn't represented yet, to give them a chance to like assign themselves to members of the standing committees?
Maybe there should be a little less formal. Who's interested in getting on a committee right now and getting some work done? And what committees are interested in?
Not me.
Do you have an interest?
Yeah, CJC.
CJC, which is, I'm glad to hear that, given everything.
That was actually my interest as well.
Infrastructure?
Welfare.
And?
CJC or infrastructure.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty good. Representative.
Where would
be Ned or Christina put your hand?
I would probably get on the infrastructure.
Yeah.
I'd
probably lean towards CJC.
Quick question. Where would Cornell Bookstore fall into?
Ari? I think we've completely eliminated Bookstore from our authority.
Yes, and that was a conscious choice. I think it's kind of difficult for me to speak for other people about it, but it was purposeful to eliminate it because it was felt it was not a campus governance function, and that the store was basically a business enterprise.
It's not private. It's operated under the Division of Financial Affairs of the university.
But it is a
enterprise.
What's the term? Yeah, it's a cost recovery unit. It's a unit that is charged. It's supposed to make a profit.
So it's one of those units that pays for the $500,000 shortfall in the parking department.
I mean, there's stuff that still can be done and people discuss with.
Okay.
As we said in the charter, you know, these issues, but not necessarily limited.
Yeah.
But it doesn't fall under the authority of a particular standing committee. The UA can still speak about it, or the UA can create an ad hoc campus bookstore committee if it so chooses.
Yes.
As the chair for the summer, we will not be creating an ad hoc committee. What the real chair in the fall would like to do is entirely up to that.
The executive board could also refer an item like that to what it felt was the most appropriate standing committee to work on.
Yeah, of course. Okay. And then, could we participate in more than one committee? Or is it highly, strongly encouraged to just focus?
I think the idea was when we came up with this numbering system, that we were worried that people's time would be pulled very thin. We did not want to limit people to one committee. But we were expecting that typically, yeah. I mean, it's certainly a possibility. I'm happy to see that there's enthusiasm and get involved right now. I'm just wondering what's going to happen when we get the faculty and a couple more employees in the fold as well. And we're missing one graduate student
who's
interested in it as well.
Because the committees aren't going to start meeting until September. It wouldn't make sense to make those decisions at the first meeting in August.
Okay. But wouldn't it make sense for a lead, especially with CJC, as some of these issues are discussed, even though they aren't meeting, just to have a point person?
Well,
I think the executive committee can.
Yeah.
I think it would deal with, yeah, the executive would approach that.
Because, I have a personal opinion on this, just because I think the old UA committee structure had no UA members on any of the UA committees, so they kind of operated like their own organization, and things got a little out of sync at times. I'm thinking, and one of the sort of points of contention, source of miscommunication, was that committees, basically the members of a committee from 1 year, might continue to operate on the assumption that they would continue to be the committee over the summer, even though their appointments were not set in any formal process, and there wasn't a lot of communication with the UA's executive committee. So I'm thinking it would be better to leave those vacant until everything can be put together so that the executive committee really is the focus of decisions.
So hold off until next.
Hold off on decisions. I mean, think about who wants to serve on which, but not actually make a decision until everybody's in the room.
Fair. Especially with two of these three committees being brand new.
I also wanted to offer a suggestion. If there are, because we're talking about 9 slots, and there are more than 9 UA members, or hopefully there will be, one way to allow more UA members to serve might be to work with the constituent assemblies and have them appoint people to some of the, because there's nothing that says that the two SA appointed members, one of them can't be a UA member.
I mean, the way I think about it is, you know, sort of math issue. So we've got 9 slots plus 4 slots for the executive, if you're assuming that the executive are not going to be eager to take on additional committee work. So that's already 13 of the 18 UA members. You know, I think we don't want to burn people out too much. I mean, if you're especially keen to serve on 3 committees. But, I mean, I think that's something to take into consideration. The graduate students are already in a position where either one person has to serve on both the executive and a committee, or one of the other two people, the non-executive people, is in a position where they have to serve on more than one committee to, you know, fill those spots. There's a sort of distribution thing. The graduate students have two fewer members than every other. Sorry.
And you're already the chair.
Right, yeah. And
the GPSA, yeah.
Right, so even granted I'm a graduate student, but speaking just as a person on the UA, that's a unique challenge to the graduate and professional student delegation because we have two fewer members. So bearing that in mind, I think it, you know, maybe that weighs against having more than other people or other constituencies being relatively overrepresented to try and share the workload at least evenly across the 18 people, if not evenly across the constituency. So I think we've reached a decision there. We have 15 minutes remaining before 6 o'clock. It had been suggested that we discuss the campus code of conduct.
Sure, and I won't speak about that for 15 minutes. But I think a couple issues have just kind of popped up as being issues. You know, we've tried to fix a lot with this new charter, but there's been a couple of things that have popped up. And I think one of them is this whole transition issue. I've been talking about transition for the past 3 meetings now. But this big thing is working with each of the constituent assemblies, you know, making sure that they have their people in the room. And we're half represented right now, which is unfortunate. And there's only one of the chairs of those constituent assemblies, which we're really hoping to bring into the fold with this whole process. And it's a little disappointing not to see any of the other chairs here today. Myself, but
employee assembly have a new chair. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, and I don't. Was Natalie Raps on the emails? I don't think she was. So
yeah.
It's conceivable that maybe Natalie just doesn't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
So you know, I'm just saying, I'm not disappointing anyone in particular. I'm just saying that this is our goal, is to get these people in the room here and hash out these issues as it moves forward. And so just, you know, moving right now is, you know, there might be a couple of adjustments or memos that need to be done internally within the UA or externally with, you know, the constituent assemblies to make sure this transition goes smoother, you know, next year. And I suggest that, you know, that this body doesn't wait until the last minute with that, but tries to take a running start in September and working with your constituent groups. The code of conduct is another issue that just kind of popped up over the last couple of weeks, and I kind of walked out of that last meeting feel very uncomfortable on how things played out for a variety of reasons. One of which, again, we tried to fix a lot of stuff in the charter is, you know, when I see the word the executive committee can speak, you know, for the assembly, that in my mind doesn't necessarily click that the executive committee can authorize, you know, a change in policy or the code of conduct, even on an interim basis.
Yep.
There might be some interpretations of that, but that's an interpretation of that that I feel very uncomfortable with. And that was one red flag that arose. I mean, we had 2 motions on the table, and I think that really addressed the first one. I was trying to figure out what exactly it meant and what the executive committee's powers in terms of adjusting even temporarily the campus code of conduct. And secondly...
sorry, if I may, just to clarify, that particular resolution didn't change any of the charter language. That resolution said speak, and the charter says speak.
Yeah.
So the ambiguity
is still
remains.
Still there.
And we were absorbed in discussion last Wednesday and didn't quite get to procedural issues.
And the other part of it that I felt very uncomfortable about, and I think we would have all gotten to the same place at the end. It was just a process problem for me, particularly in the fact that we were making a interim, maybe more long-term amendment to a very important and very sensitive document on a very ad hoc basis.
Mm-hmm.
I was very, I think, disappointed in the process that led, basically the people who were proposing the amendment to basically scratch their heads for what exactly, the wording should be, how it should be all laid out. And this was a red flag in my mind, especially serving as a member of the university's board of trustees. I do understand that governments, and those decisions need to happen quick. But, because it is a legalistic document where changes in it can affect, liabilities, people's rights, I was very uncomfortable with stuff happening on an ad hoc basis in the way that it did. And that's not saying anything against anybody who is in this room. But I think, Ed and I talked about it after the meeting, and we basically realized that it's just a very messy, unclear system, especially in regards to the campus code of conduct and how that's treated. And looking back, it seems like a document that should have a statement in the charter on how it should be amended, what kind of vote it needs, whether it's a majority or a two-thirds vote, instructions out of committee it needs. And certainly this is a brand new case, I think, for the university, is what happens in a emergency situation like this. I mean, it could be something where we the UA just grants the executive committee full power to deal with emergency situations, regardless of what they are. When it came to the point, well, if we need to change the UA charter on an emergency basis, can the executive committee speaking for the UA do that? And that was the stuff that really, when I thought thinking about it, really hurt me. And then the chart is a little bit more specific spelled out. But the problem is the code of conduct isn't, and there might be some other things that we missed with the chart of this year. So that's my, I think, final warning as things move forward, and I hope that these issues are looked into and embraced as the year moves on.
Well, it would be my hope that at least in part, having the CJC consist of, at minimum, three UA members would help avoid this situation. The first question I asked at the meeting last Wednesday was, when did you get this letter from the Department of Education? They got it 3 weeks before.
Right.
It was on April 4th. So that was 3 weeks that somebody had this letter in their possession. I don't know if only the JA knew about it or if the CJC knew about it, but certainly the UA didn't know about it.
The JA told me that she had asked them to meet about it about 2 weeks before the UA meeting.
So it would be my hope that going forward, with UA members on the CJC, that one of them might say, hey guys, red flag, we've got this big issue coming up, we need to get this on the agenda, we need to start discussing this, and that we might put ourselves in a position where if we have an emergency situation like that, somebody can come in, language in hand, ready for a vote, language that's been vetted in advance, that's been read by more than one party,
I think it was also reported in the Chronicle of Higher Ed that those letters were sent out to all the colleges across the country, so I thought there's something that, we could have just, one of us could have read that in the newspaper and, put them an email asking them, what's going on with this, so...
Yeah, and that I think having people, specific people, always alert for those sorts of issues because they're on those committees will help rather than having 19 people who kind of read the newspaper and engage individually. Are there any further points? We have 5 minutes remaining. Chair would also entertain a motion to adjourn if there are no further.
I could give an update on what's going on with that because the committee did meet after the UA meeting.
Yes.
And they are working on the strongly worded letter, which will not be so strongly worded from what I've seen. But they're expecting to send a letter kind of laying out
what they think the process should be moving forward, either later this evening or sometime tomorrow. Basically, what this letter from the Office of Civil Rights of the U.S. Education Department has said is that the standard of evidence that Cornell happens to use, which is clear and convincing, which means, as I've had it explained to me before, you have to be really sure that somebody is guilty before you convict them, like 90% sure. Not beyond reasonable doubt, which is 99% in this scale, which is kind of subjective, but it's not as strong as beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's less than preponderance of evidence, which has been described as 51%. And what? And a few people involved in the hearing and review board system have said that to the layperson who is involved in this system, the standard of evidence is kind of a difficult thing to apply anyway, because, you know, either they think the person did it or they don't. Anyhow, if we set that aside for a moment, our standard is clear and convincing, and what this letter says is that that standard is fundamentally unfair to victims, and in the context of balancing victims of sexual harassment and sexual assault, balancing their rights to be protected against the rights of the whole community, the rights of the accused person to defend themselves against it, the only fair standard is preponderance of evidence. That is, if the university or whoever the university is charged to do the investigation thinks that the person committed the offense more likely than they didn't, the university should be taking what it thinks is appropriate action to protect the victim. Now, there's a lot more nuance and complications to that, and the sort of core question for the CJC that's becoming very vexing is, if the U.S. government has said that that standard is unfair for victims of this particular class of offenses, what do we do for all the other offenses that aren't covered by this particular law that are still following the clear and convincing standard? And they're sort of talking about going in two directions with it. One is have a separate policy just for sexual harassment and sexual assault. And the other one would be, should we reconceptualize what the code is about? And the last time that came up was about 5 years ago, when there was a... Does anybody here remember the Crash Report? which is still... basically was a year-long discussion within the UA. And all of that information is still online. I could make sure we circulate a link for you if you want to read up about it over the summer, because it is a longer discussion. But I certainly think that the CJC is looking to be involved in that conversation, even if it starts to happen over the summer. And they're also looking for some guidance from whoever is responsible for this process, which is the UA, as to which direction to go. You know, should the campus code be following more of this, what we call a civil law model, or should it be following more of the criminal model that it is currently based on? And I don't think anybody thinks that's an easy question, so.
Yeah, but
I hope that'll be helpful background information.
I mean, given that the last rewrite of the code was, I think, 3 or 4 years ago now, that being approved, and that being such a major rewrite that was 20 years in the making, perhaps?
I think that clarified a lot of the code. I don't think it fundamentally changed the system.
Okay. I guess it's probably worthwhile at this point looking back in and seeing
what was,
you know, while there's still some recent memory of, you know, the debate that happened, you know, 3 years ago.
And the principal author of that revision has been a member of the Codes and Judicial Committee since, and is probably still going to be next year, is Kevin Claremont, who's a law professor.
A letter of fame from my school. So, it's now 6 o'clock. We need a motion to extend the meeting or a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn. Seconded by Ned. Any objections?
Any objections?
Any objections? Meeting adjourned, 6:01 p.m.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.